Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and this is the second of three interviews with authors of new books in English about Hungary's 10-year evolution away from liberal democracy under Prime Minister Viktor Orban. My discussion with Gabor Schering about his retreat of liberal democracy was released on the European Studies channel on January the 14th, and my interview with Lesa Skut about his Orban Land will be out in March. But today it's the turn of András Kurosheny, the author, together with Gábor Iás and Attila Gyulay, of The Orban Regime, Plebiscitary Leader Democracy in the Making, published in 2020 by Routledge. András is a senior research fellow at the Center for Social Sciences and professor of political science at Corvinus University in Budapest. He is the author of 14 books, 5 in English, and has also been a research fellow in Vienna, Heidelberg, Harvard, Leiden, and Oxford. András, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
At the core of your book is an argument that Viktor Orban and his regime fit nicely into a leadership model set out by Max Weber more than 100 years ago. And this is something he called plebiscitary leader democracy, or we'll call it PLD from now on. In fact, you write that early on, you say, quote, "The Orban regime has turned out to be a natural laboratory for studying PLD." Can you explain the features of PLD and why it beats other frameworks in describing this regime?
Well, yes, I try to do this. Well, I think probably the major or crucial trait of PLD is a different relation between political leaders and followers, leaders and citizens. And the 20th century democracies, well, by and large, we may call them party democracies or representative democracies, parliamentary democracies, where there was an important filter between citizens and leaders, and institutions between citizens and leaders, and our whole imagination about democracy, that is a kind of bottom-up process, and political parties and parliaments had a crucial role in this bottom-up process throughout the 20th century, and the parties connected citizens and the state and government and that was a kind of intermediation, a filter, one hand a filter, and another hand political parties represented the demands of certain social groups and then the society as a whole. And the first major trait of plebiscitary leader democracy is a direct link between political leaders and citizens. And this direct That is some way a consequence of various parallel trends which were taking place in democracies from the last two decades of the 20th century and by the third of the millennium it became clear, and there are some literature on that, and this process includes the fall of the decline of political parties, parliaments, end of strong party loyalty and stability of the party system. So a process of de-alignment, more volatile electoral behavior of citizens. And this process produced a kind of personalization of politics. At the beginning of this century, there was a concept in political science called presidentialization of democracies, and that was meant that the European parliamentary democracies became so personalized like the American presidential system that political leaders became the center figure of electoral campaigns, unlike in the previous century, where they were the political parties and the party manifestos, and political leaders, the incumbent leaders, emerge as a stronger figure within the executive power, and also they preside their political party, so that previously parties had leaders, but it was told by this literature that by now political leaders have parties. And so that's this whole process, the sense of personalization, the emergence of charismatic politicians, and to a large extent, or some extent, it is a general phenomenon. And and this kind of, there are, the literature says, for example, Jeffrey Green's book from 2010, The Eyes of the People, that there's a plebiscitary era in democracy, which means citizens became just an audience of what's going on the political stage, what leaders perform, do, and watch their struggle, and then they either applaud them or reject them. And so that's a kind of yes or no. So that's why it is a plebiscitary type of relationship. And so this is one part of the story. And there is another part that is more, well, local, I mean, Hungarian, or how, and the problem of de-democratization or democratic backslide, and the major approach of the literature, how to grasp, how to analyze this process. And the mainstream of the literature is this, what we call the hybrid regime, use the hybrid regime approach. And the hybrid regime approach, which regards liberal democracy as a kind of ideal politics and among political regimes, and the hybrid regime approach compare any regime to an ideal of liberal democracy, and the focus of this approach to find out the difference, the traits, the deviations from liberal democratic ideal, and it is a sort of teleological approach which set up a unidimensional scale and situate all regimes on this scale from the one end where the liberal democracies are, and the other end where closed authoritarian regimes or dictatorships, and the hybrid regimes are between the ideal types and in the middle, in the gray zone. But it is a quite large, this gray zone is so wide and so large that sometimes the differences among these gray zone regimes are more or larger than the difference to liberal democracy or to authoritarian regimes. And so this is a useful approach if we are looking for the difference from liberal democracy, and this literature characterizes why, well, Orbán's Hungary or other regimes, how it is, what is the difference to a liberal democratic ideal, but it is a kind of negative characterization, so that it's a list that the rule of law is violated, the elections are well free but not fair, and things like that. It's a kind of negative characterization. So we know much about to which extent it is not liberal democracy, but we know much less about how this kind of regimes and how Orbán's Hungary really look like and really works, what is its own modus operandi, what is different from liberal democracy, but the hybrid regime approach doesn't say what is this logic. So we were dissatisfied with this mainstream literature, and that's why, sorry, it was a little bit long. That's why we try to find a different framework to, but and we found Max Weber's conceptual framework useful to understand and to describe and analyze a certain type of regimes in this gray zone and the Hungarian Orbán regime.
Yeah, before I started reading the book, I was skeptical really about the title, this idea of the plebiscitary leader model. I think he's only called one referendum, I think, while he's been prime minister, and he was instrumental in calling another when he was in opposition. But you explain the thinking behind this, the idea of elections themselves having a plebiscitary nature. And you say, for example, quote, elections are regarded as an authorization to embody the will of the people. And several of the elections, for example, the one in 2014, there was no manifesto. I mean, similar to the Republican election campaign in the United States last year. And really, the campaign was simply on a slogan of "We continue," and that the election campaigns are basically marked by huge posters of the prime minister, and then Fidesz, his party, is only brought into the campaign at the last minute. So it did make a lot more sense in that respect.
We claim in the book that elections became, and the representation became this type of plebiscitary representation, and plebiscitary type of election, approval or rejection of a leader. So this way it became a yes or no elections. But it is not just referendums, but really only one referendum. And actually, the Orbán regime and the new constitution of Hungary accepted in 2011 under the Orbán regime is weakened the institution of referendum comparing to the previous constitution. So there was a shift away from referendum. Where citizens and associations had a chance to initiate a referendum, to push through a certain initiative for a national referendum and a direct decision by the people. So that it was weakened, and so that referendum, but it was used only once, and it is it has a plebiscitary nature. Plebiscitarism also means that the issue is provided and given for the referendum or for the citizens' choice by the executive or by the ruler, by the government or by the legislator, so that. And this also highlights that kind of nature that politics is very much formed and shaped by political leaders and citizens are only passive audience of this performance and they may approve it or reject it. And the citizen's choice this way became a kind of legitimacy. Measure. And that's also, instead of referendums, but instead of, in the Orbán regime, there was a special kind of, I would say informal referendum was introduced, that is the so-called national consultations, where the government, like in referendums, the government ask questions, send these questions to citizens through postal service, and the citizens may reply, filling out a questionnaire about a potential government policy about well, social welfare program or reduction of utility prices or migration. Or economic policy or family policy. And so that is a means of the government, means of the regime to gain legitimacy, to gain approval of the people. And this is one aspect why elections and this is not a formal referendum, and that it makes even more strange measure but it makes it even more characteristic that it is a kind of authoritarian measure to gain legitimacy, but on the other hand also a kind of mobilization of the citizens behind the government's policy.
Do you think the scale of his victory in 2010 was crucial to the development of this regime? I mean, there was this leaked speech from the former Prime Minister, Ferenc Gyurcsány, that really undermined the legitimacy of the previous government and meant that Orbán and Fidesz was able to win this two-thirds majority, which has enabled him to carry out what you call almost constant constitution making. Without that, he wouldn't have been able to. So do you think that victory in 2010, if he had just won by two seats, we would have a very different Orbán regime today?
I think so, yes. Yes, that was... it is clear why it is so, that technically a two-mandate majority would have not been enough for constitutional changes and changes of many... so-called two-third legislation, so that where qualitative majority is necessary, two-third majority is necessary for legislation. There were even in the previous constitution many even policy issues, not just institutional and regulatory issues. The policy issues belong to this category, and this the landslide. So the landslide victory provided a constitutional majority for Orbán, and through a very disciplined political parliamentary group of the Fidesz, it worked automatically. So the decision or will of the leader was automatically executed by a very disciplined parliamentary group, where usually that was the government, but often not the government, but there were private member deals, especially between 2010 and 2014. Many initiative of Orbán and the Fidesz was introduced to the parliament by private member deals, and this way they were able to avoid certain constraints in the procedure, in the debate of the bill, and made it more efficient and swept away the opposition this way. So first, this two-third majority, and secondly, that is maybe even more important, that the landslide victory provided a very strong legitimacy for Orbán's ambition and Orbán's regime change. So this legitimacy, the legitimacy of the regime change, the legitimacy of the accomplishment of a new constitution, and that was extended or strengthened by a third factor, and that is the political discourse, that is the political narrative that Orbán used. And through the landslide victory, the two-third majority, the new constitution, he was able to produce a very very strong division, a caesura from the previous period, from the period between 1990 and 2010, and this previous period, what was regarded as the new democratic period of Hungary, became in this narrative a kind of ambiguous, vague, suspicious period where the democratic transition was not carried out completely, where the post-communist politicians and the Socialist Party and post-communist politicians like Ferenc Gyurcsány in 2006 were able to divert the whole development through electoral manipulations, what was the bomb, political bomb, in the, when it was leaked in 2006, Gyurcsány's speech, in which he admitted that they lied and manipulated the figures in the electoral campaign and previously. So that what is so that the 2010 election, I think that was a crucial for in this regime change, and without this landslide, well, there may have been also something different, but the two-third majority and the two-third majority again 4 years later and again for another years later, that was a feedback. So the Hungarian electorate may have rejected this Orbán's regime reconstruction in 2014, but that actually did not happen. So that regained the two-third majority and strengthened the legitimacy even more, and 2018 even more. So that is really a very strong and very robust way of restructuring of the political landscape, the political discourse, the political landscape, the political institutions, and beyond all of this political sphere, social relations and economic relations, including a robust elite change initiative didn't carried out by under Orbán's leadership during these 10 years.
Yeah, one thing that I have found puzzling, looking not only at Orbán but other similar leaders, is that given the he had so much power that developed from 2010 onwards, and that he has done so much to to reshape the cultural discourse, the institutions, and so on. Underlying that appears to be a lack of ultimate strategy. And you introduce two concepts in the book that I think really help to understand this. The first is this, the other thinker, apart from Max Weber, look at is Carl Schmitt, the very controversial German political thinker, and this idea of the primacy of politics, and that the main role of politics is to have the capacity to act, to the freedom of room for the leader to shape institutions and shape policy, which, by the way, reminded me quite a lot of a French politician of Hungarian descent, Nicolas Sarkozy. That was absolutely his way of thinking. And the other is this idea you introduce of bricolage, so a lack of strategy, but finding things that work. And you say, quote, leadership in the Orbán regime is much more dependent on the next step than the sum of the steps ahead. Can you elaborate on this idea and why it is you think there is this lack of strategy to the Orbán regime?
Yes, so there is some kind of paradox or contradiction here, that it is often told that the Orbán regime has some robust right-wing nationalist or conservative ideology, and reshape everything into a certain very specific direction according to the master plan, and the opposite, so that there is no master plan, ad hoc decisions, completely unpredictable, incoherent policy in every policy era, and by and large as well. So the lack of strategy, and there's a pragmatism that may be summarized in the slogan that the rule of the moment, that's the basic principle of Orbán's leadership. So this contradiction that disturbed us very much during the time when we were working on this book, and it was not easy to solve what is the real relation between these, because both seems correct, and I think both are correct to some extent, but then what is the relation? Well, the relation is that we emphasize in the book that there is no coherent policy in public policy level. There is no coherent policy in economic policy or in education policy or in social policy. If within each policy areas there are incoherences, unorthodox measures, heterodox measures, partly etatist measures, on the other hand, extremely neoliberal measures like the flat tax, the personal income tax, and things like that. So that sometimes the Orbán regime is accused to be etatist and hyper-centralization, but on the other hand, but right now there is a program that the higher education is but is a state regulated and state owned higher education is private, is under privatization, or will be partly already privatized. My university has been privatized, or the other universities will be also privatized, but not to private owners, but to foundations established by the state. And this way, the link between the central education policy and the university to be cut some way. But in the curatorium of this foundation, there will be, well, urban loyalists, or most of them are regarded as urban loyalists. So, okay, so that how to... Are they compatible, this the master plan or the pragmatic policy? So we try to explore in the book so that on a public policy level there are no coherent policy paradigms, but at a larger level of abstraction there are some kind of coherence. Orbán has some kind of vision. Charismatic politicians usually have a vision, and this vision is the core of this vision is very important for the core supporters of Orbán and Fidesz, so that the and this vision includes the national emphasis on national sovereignty, the freedom fight against multinational firms, against Brussels, freedom fights against the network of George Soros, fight against the inner allies, the opposition politicians who allied with these international interests and international actors. And Christian and conservative values, the regime support the church is very much the historical churches, and so that and also a kind of even the elite change that I mentioned, but sometimes seems to be quite rude when. Appointees or officials, leading officials of certain institutions within the public sphere are dismissed and replaced by Fidesz loyalists, and this process began in the economy and in the state administration and after 2018 go ahead in the cultural sphere more widely or effectively than before. And so even this elite change is can be put into some kind of coherent vision. And the role of this elite change is to develop a national conservative right-wing elite in every sphere of the society, but was in reality missing before 2010. So after the democratic transition in 1990, or even after the turn of the century, the majority of the elite regarding their values that was liberal or left, leaning and regarding their party preferences, they were either liberals or socialists, and the media is also important here, so that the media elite, that was especially perspective, the mass media and the media elite, and but after the loss of the election of 2002, Orbán was first a prime minister between 1998 and 2002, and after the loss of the election of 2002, during the 8 years of opposition, he began to build up a media network, a right-leaning media network that was missing before, step by step. So by 2010, it was important, and then later, from 2010 onwards, he was able to take in the public media under his control as well, and also in the privately owned media pushed further the widening of his influence. So that so there is a kind of vision about a sovereign Hungary in within the European Union, but within a European Union, which is not a federalist European Union, but a union of independent nation states, and Hungary is first, so that is it is this we found that it is not nationalism or conservatism, but is some kind of overarching ideological trait of the regime, but a certain kind of realism, which sounds like that it is the interest of the it is the interest of the country or interest of the Hungarian nation. Many policy steps, the opening to the East, the special relation with Russia, the special relation with China, all of these policy decisions and the policy are justified that it is in the national interest and in national interests enjoy a priority against principles and values.
One of the big advantages he has had, and you could argue that he's helped create this, has been the division of the opposition. From the end of 2020, the opposition are now united in a joint campaign for the 2022 election. Do you think there is a chance that this could be the end of the Orbán regime next year?
Probably that is the most important development in Hungarian domestic politics of the last couple of years. That's what you raise. So that that technically the stability of the Orbán regime in the sense of parliamentary majority based on the division of the opposition, so that the Fidesz was in the center and there were many splinter groups on the left and one political party, the Jobbik, on the right. Until 2018, this kind of division worked and then provided a stability for the large center party. And that it's a sense of that's an electoral mathematics. So that even in 2014 or 2018, a united opposition may have reached a completely different result, a much stronger parliamentary representation, and that would have killed the two-thirds, the supermajority of the Fidesz, and so that I think that the next election, 2022, that may produce a different result, even if Fidesz win the election. It is less likely that Fidesz would reach a supermajority and that would produce a very different domestic politics. This overwhelming, robust advantage within the parliament may be over, and that will change things very much. I would not exclude that the opposition may win, so that according to the public opinion service, that's possible.
Well, to finish, I'd like to ask every guest to recommend a book. András, what have you chosen and why?
Well, I chose the book written by David A. Bell. It is titled Man on Horseback. The subtitle is The Power of Charisma in the Age of Evolution. And it was published in the autumn of 2020. And it's a little bit connected to the major concept of our book, charisma. So it is a historical account of the emergence of charismatic political leaders, charismatic leaders who appeared during the revolutions and freedom fights in the late 18th and early 19th century, like Pasqua Paoli, a leader of Corsican independence struggle, and then George Washington, the general of the American War of Independence, Napoleon Bonaparte, Simon Bolivar, the liberator of Haiti. And so that it is interesting for me. For me, it was interesting, but there is some kind of irony in this book, that it is often claimed that charismatic political leaders may be dangerous to democracy. There is some kind of tension or contradiction, leadership and democracy. But the irony is that personal political leaders, charismatic leaders, have the same origin than modern democracy. That is this late 18th, early 19th century, the age of enlightenment, the age of revolutions and independent wars, liberalism, democracy. On one hand, and political leadership, charismatic leadership, on the other hand, they were twin products of this age. And this is due to the fact that traditional authority, monarchs, aristocracy, the church, that their authority had been undermined, and that changed the relationship between ordinary people and their political leaders and this leadership. So that enlightenment brought not just the emergence of rationalism, but also emotions and enthusiasm of citizens or ordinary people to their own leaders. And that's also, so this is also the age of emergence of personalized leadership. So that's a book of a history book. I like it very much.
Thank you. That's an interesting choice. So today I have been talking to András Kurosheny about his new book, The Orbán Regime, Plebiscitary Leader Democracy in the Making, published in 2020 by Routledge. András, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.